Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. October 9th, our quote for the day from Gore Vidal: as societies grow decadent, the language grows decadent too. Words are used to disguise, not to illuminate action. You liberate a city by destroying it. Words are to confuse, so that election time people will solemnly vote against their own interests. Speaking of our own interests, Bill Gertz is with us. He's the author of numerous previous books with some very provocative titles. Hang on just a second here. Let me get over to his website, Gertzfile, GERTZfile.com, and Enemies, Treachery, Breakdown, The China Threat and Betrayal, and his new book, The Failure Factory, How Unelected Bureaucrats, Liberal Democrats, and Big Government Republicans Are Undermining America's Security and Leading Us to War. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to have you. You're also a columnist for The Washington Times,
yes,
I should add, and, as I said, New York Times bestselling author. Looking through your book here, one of the things that struck me was a certain, and I don't mean this as a slam, but a certain schizophrenia in that you, for example, in your introduction, you talk about how anti-American forces are subverting get-tough policies, undercutting our position in the war on terrorism, shifting back to ineffective law enforcement, preventing much-needed domestic security programs. It seems like you're asking for bigger government in the same chapter that you're decrying bigger government.
Not really. What I'm what this book is a critical assessment of what I've described as a highly politicized, out of control government bureaucracy, meaning that basically this liberal bureaucracy has usurped the elected authority of the U.S. Basically, when a president comes in, he has about 3,000 to 4,000 political appointees that he appoints that are basically to represent his policies. And in The Failure Factory, I point out that these positions have been taken over by career bureaucrats. And this is the result of neglect, of misguided policymakers, of not understanding the mechanics of the federal government. And I argue,
so is this a failure on the part of the Bush administration, because neither Bush nor Cheney have any training at law or in government? They're both MBAs.
Well, I think it goes even before this administration. It's something that's been developing for at least the last two administrations. I actually trace it to the Kennedy administration, where you had, in the national security area, you had Robert McNamara, who really created what is today the modern bureaucratic system. And that has become highly politicized, and it's my argument is it's not just a nuisance, but it's actually dangerous, because it's limiting the government from really functioning effectively, and most importantly, from the national security standpoint, dealing with foreign threats.
Mm-hmm. It seems, you know, I'm curious about your use of language, Bill. We're talking about Bill Gertz, his new book, The Failure Factory. The founders of this country call themselves liberals. You know, George Washington famously said, "I hope America is ever at the forefront of liberality." It was the liberal enlightenment, the whole period. And the conservatives, by and large, were the ones who did not want us to separate from England. And then you had, you know, our first conservative president, John Adams, you know, pushing through the Alien Sedition Acts. And basically the conservative philosophy in this country has largely and always been, and I say this as somebody who went door to door for Barry Goldwater, and you know, I've read The Conservative Mind, and I've read Goldwater's works, and I've, you know, read and corresponded with Bill Buckley over the years. The conservative worldview historically has been one of we can't trust the rabble. If a large number of people are involved in, for example, democracy, and running a democracy, there's going to be a disaster. They'll all vote themselves tax breaks and bankrupt the government. There needs to be a governing elite. And what you're describing here is a governing elite. This seems like a conservative philosophy rather than a liberal philosophy.
Actually, no. The tone of the book I trace, and I sum it up in the beginning with a quote from Ronald Reagan in 1981, his inaugural address. He said, "We're a nation that has a government, not the other way around, and this makes us special among the nations of the earth. Our government has no power except that granted to it by the people. It's time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed."
Well, it's nice rhetoric, but it's the exact opposite of what he did.
Well,
as
actually,
you well know.
Well, no, I would
think Ronald Reagan presided over the largest increase in the size of government and largest increase in the size of the debt of our government in the history of the United States.
Oh,
and only George W. Bush has beat him
on. That may be true of the Bush administration. That's certainly not true of the Reagan administration.
Reagan came into office, our debt was less than $1 trillion. He left office, it was more than $3 trillion. He put $3 trillion on our national credit card. We're still paying over $200 billion a year in credit in interest on the money that Reagan borrowed.
Well, that was just to rebuild the military after it's been had been decimated in the previous administration.
Well, regardless of what the rationale is, the fact of the matter is Reagan...
That was spending. That wasn't government. That was just the spending part. He didn't build new government agencies. I mean, there were a couple that came online, but for the most part, that was his philosophy.
Well, okay, I'll give you that. Most of that money that he borrowed in our names, he gave to his good buddies in the defense industry for Star Wars. But, you know, which... It's rather tragic, I think. You Stephen Cambone, for example, here in the Pentagon Puzzle Palace chapter of your book, you call him a liberal Republican who worked for Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. What makes him liberal?
Well, he has what I call a Benz Republican, or business executives for national security. He didn't have a conservative philosophy. He believed in big government, and his policies when he came in reflected that. He made some egregious errors that I highlight in the book.
How is believing in big government liberal? I thought liberals just wanted a government that reflects the will of the people, that does what the people wanted. That's the liberal founding philosophy of this country.
Big government Republicans are those who think that government is the solution rather than the problem.
Well, it seems to me that big government Republicans are Republicans who think that the government is a piggy bank that they can use to pass out largesse to their buddies.
Well, like I say,
there are a few Democrats in that category as well.
Yeah, but from the national security side, with the Pentagon and the State Department, and those are people who defer to the government bureaucrats and let them make the decisions. And my argument in the failure factory is that was not just a huge mistake, but that has actually undermined our national security.
Yeah. We're talking with Bill Gertz, G-E-R-T-Z, GertzFile.com is his website. GertzFile.com. Bill, in the China Syndrome chapter, you get into Hank Paulson. This was a little prescient. And you talk about 2006 Goldman Sachs buying into China's biggest bank, the Commercial Bank of China, for $2.5 billion. And you go on about Goldman Sachs at some length here. What are your thoughts about Paulson right now?
Well, I think that chapter highlights the problem. You know, Paulson invested enormous amount of time and energy as Treasury Secretary for the past few years in developing this, what they call the strategic economic dialogue with China. He made numerous trips to China. He focused all his attention on trying to develop economic dialogue with China, which produced really zero. And, you know, this, at the same time, our financial system was about to melt down, which we saw in the last 2 weeks. I think it's a scandal.
Your recommendations toward the end: remove all intelligence agencies from the career civil service system. You want to replace intelligence officers, lifetime career intelligence officers, people who, you know, from the time they were kids wanted to be spies or whatever and ended up doing, with what, political hacks, political appointees, people who are going to say what the president wants them to say this week?
Actually, I call for Congress to create a nomination process for senior intelligence analysts, which we don't have right now. I mean, if you look at this National Intelligence Council, which produced this highly politicized Iran NIE last December, some of these people on there were involved in the Iraq weapons of mass destruction program. I mean, in other words, they were involved in one of the biggest intelligence failures of time. They haven't been moved off. So I say we should have Senate confirmable positions for senior intelligence analysts. As for removing
that politicizes it, though. I mean, why?
Well, how is that? I mean, how does that politicize it? It makes for more oversight.
When somebody goes into civil service, there can't be a political process involved. You can't take into consideration what their party affiliation is. If Congress is vetting people for intelligence work. First of all, I don't think most members of Congress are qualified. But secondly, they're going to be asking, are you a Democrat or Republican? Whichever party is in power is going to be the one that's favoring the people that they're hiring.
Not necessarily. They're going to see who's the most qualified. And that's what they do now with Senate confirmable positions. And
I think you have more faith in big government than I do, Bill. But, Bill, we've got to wrap it up. Your book, The Failure Factory, How Unelected Bureaucrats, Liberal Democrats, and Big Government Republicans Are Undermining America's Security and Leading Us to War. Bill Gertz. GertzFile.com. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. I got to tell you what's going on out there in the States right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. It seems to me that there's just the conservatives are in total free fall meltdown right now. Here we have the Bush administration about to nationalize banks. We have the Wall Street Journal on their editorial page calling for Henry Paulson to buy Citibank. I mean, you talk about socialism on steroids. This is incredible. And you know, the conservatives are running around like chickens. They just don't know what to do. The system is breaking down. It's breaking down as a consequence of 26 years of Republican and conservative mismanagement and misrule. Excuse me. Sneezing there. Just exactly as happened in the 1920s, when we had a decade of Republican mismanagement and misrule, and that led directly to the Republican Great Depression. And here it is all over again. And they're lost. They're freaking out. They don't know what to do. And the problems is that they're trying to deal with this at the top. They're trying to attack this thing from the top, and you can't. It doesn't work to attack it from the top. It's not going to work to attack it from the top. What they need to be doing is they need to be raising the minimum wage, encouraging unionization, providing people with extensions of their unemployment benefits, providing a national health care system immediately to take the burden off employers and off workers, and restoring tariffs to our trade system so that we can have some semblance of normalcy in trade. We need to have a trade system that resembles that of Korea, China, Japan, and other successful countries, successful economies, where we say, you know, if you're going to make something with cheaper labor, we're going to charge an import tax, a tariff, when you import it into our country. We need, I mean, this is just fundamental stuff. Let's rebuild this country from the bottom up. Instead, they're trying to do it from the top down. Henry Paulson has just, you know, overnight they dropped the Fed fund rate by a half a point, the interest rate. And this is the 10th time since August of 2007 that this has happened. This one was coordinated with the Bank of England, the Swiss Central Bank, the Riksbank of Sweden, the Bank of China, and the European Central Bank. But, you know, here's the problem. If you go back to September 1st, the Dow is down to 2,500 points. That's, 21% of its value. It is amazing. In fact, as Julian De Las Centellas points out in the current issue of Asia Times, an article Bernanke running out of ammo, This week marks the first anniversary of the all-time high of the Dow at just under 14,300. Since then, the market has lost 35% of its value, over 5,000 points, or almost $9 trillion of investor wealth. For those who like their karma extra sweet, this week is not only the first anniversary of the all-time high of the market, but it's also the first anniversary of the premiere of the Fox Business Network. Yeah. Now, here's the problem. The credit markets are frozen up, and what the way that they're frozen up is that is has to do with short-term lending. Banks lending to other banks, financial institutions lending to other financial institutions, bank lending to companies, short-term debt, bridge debt, payroll, cover your payroll debt, things like that. The short-term, and the demand is out there, and that demand is driving up the price of money. The London Interbank Offered Rate, the LIBOR rate, for example, and the Fed Funds Market Rate, that's, by the way, the Fed Funds Market Rate is the rate at which is the interest rate that people actually have to pay, as opposed to the Fed Funds Target Rate, which is the rate that the Fed wants people to pay, have been spiking. I mean, LIBOR has been over 3.5%, 3.75% in the last 2 weeks. It's just, you know, the Fed funds rate, the market rate has been running as high as almost 4%, whereas the target rate is 2%. So basically what's happening is that the Fed is trying to drive down the interest rate that banks charge each other, and they're saying, no, we're not going to do it. And getting that rate down, this is there's a trillion-dollar credit lockup right now, and it could be a whole hell of a lot more than that coming down the road. Keep in mind the derivatives market, Alan Greenspan's derivative market, this market that didn't even exist when Ronald Reagan became president, that Alan Greenspan single-handedly birthed, the great article about this in the front page of today's New York Times, is now a $500 trillion market. Keep in mind, the entire GDP of the entire planet is only $67 trillion. So there's all this make-believe money out there that has just been created out of nowhere. And people are going, you know, well, we need some cash. So they're pulling out this fire hose of, well, here's $700 billion we're going to throw at the system. Sorry, ain't going to work. Well, we're going to drop interest rates by a half a point. Sorry, it ain't going to work. There's just not enough money. Bernanke doesn't have the tools anymore. The damage has been too deep. We have over 26 years, we have damaged the fundamentals of the economy of this country so badly by Reaganomics. Reaganomics we have lost 5 million, some would say as many as 10 million manufacturing jobs. We're throwing Americans into poverty. We have a situation now where the top 1% of Americans get 90% of the wealth and 50% of the income. It is out of control. In order to fix this problem, we have to go back to the fundamentals. We have to deal with the core fundamentals rather than just try to spray, a little money on the problem. It's not going to work. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Please welcome the presumptive Republican candidate for president, Senator John McCain.
My friends, if I'm elected, I'm gonna be getting on in years. I could be the oldest guy who's ever won. Hell, Ronald Reagan could be my son. Now look at the future, my second term. Think of what's in store. Now do you really want me running the country when I'm 84? There's gonna be some really sweet perks if I get the job. I will have advantages to get things done, like pre-boarding on Air Force One. And when I ask world leaders to dine, one thing is for sure. We never late night 'em, cause when I invite 'em, dinner's served at four. Every Easter Sunday, kids will roll eggs at the White House, so I'll step outside and shout, hey kids, get on my
my lawn!
When I ride in my limousine, I'll have one blinker on. Don't be concerned, my views are too old. I'm a modern guy. Many staunch conservatives you may have heard don't think evolution occurred. Well, they should ask me. I saw it firsthand. With my dinosaur, I turned to a tadpole, and then I met Bob Dole. The year we both turned more.
35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America. By the way, I want to devote an entire hour to this topic of voter fraud and election fraud and what's going on in the United States right now. It has finally hit the mainstream media, the corporate media, the New York Times, running a piece about how the voting polls, voting rolls are being stripped in state after state. States where massive voter registration campaigns are underway actually have fewer voters now registered in them than they did a year ago. And how this is being played out, by whom it's being played out, and interestingly, the response of the Clinton supporters to this. But I want to get into that in the next hour because I really want to do it right and spend the time with it. Let me just wrap this topic up of the economy. Number one, our conservative alert for the day. This, Dana Perino, the White House press secretary. Just listen to this from yesterday.
You mentioned earlier about the pain everybody's feeling as a result of voting. Well, the House passed an unemployment extension bill, which would extend unemployment for all states for 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And for those that have high unemployment, above 6%, for an additional 13. Would the White House support this bill?
Just 7 weeks,
well,
please.
Unless legislation starts moving that I'm not aware of and Congress isn't here, I don't know how we could support it.
The Senate comes back in November 17th.
Well, let's take it up then, Paul. I mean, it's October 8th. So there's a long way to go between now and then.
People that won't have unemployment checks between October 15th.
Well, my point is, Paula, that one of the things that we want is we want people to be able to return to work. We understand that there are people that are hurting, but we've already extended the unemployment benefits. But if legislation isn't moving between now and November 17th, if then, there's not a lot that we can do in terms of getting a law passed.
So you assume that in states that have high unemployment, that those people will be able to find jobs between October and
I hope that everybody who wants to find a job is able to find a job. I can only imagine the anxiety for people who are looking for a job and can't find one. And it's hard to put myself in their shoes because I haven't been in that situation. But
no,
obviously
haven't.
States, and there are many of them, that have high unemployment rates, have a lot of people who are suffering. But getting back to work would be the best way to help all of us collectively, them individually, and then us as a country.
So that's the solution to the unemployment crisis. Get a job! Well, it would be nice. I'll tell you, there's a lot of people out there looking really hard. These people are nuts. They're just friggin' nuts. And so now Henry Paulson is doing the very last thing that he's got. Keep in mind, the problem is the international short-term credit market. A lot of it is corporate paper. And it's a multi-trillion dollar market. And it's not, this is, you know, it's like you've got a steel mill in India trying to deal international. Well, for example, this from this Asia Times piece. Since the commercial paper market stretches across the globe, is the U.S. Fed really going to backstop transactions between an Icelandic bank and an Indian steel company? Still, this could be a short-term strategy employed from now until the U.S. election, after which it is hoped the adults might be in charge. Well, when you listen to the next hour of this show, you're going to wonder whether the adults will be in charge. But, you know, for the moment, yeah, it would be nice to have the adults in charge. And we need, frankly, over at Alternet, there's a progressive voter guide to the economy. Again, it doesn't go anywhere near far enough, but it's a start. Let's deal with aspiring inequality and the assault on unions. 80% of the country's inflation-adjusted income since Ronald Reagan was elected has gone to the top 1%. And the incomes of all but the top 10% have actually declined. 59% of American workers would be inclined to join a union. Fewer than 10% are members of unions. Let's raise the minimum wage. Obama was a co-sponsor of the Employee Free Choice Act. John McCain voted against it. Number two, the housing and debt crisis. You have 6.5 million U.S. houses that may go into foreclosure by 2012. This could put 12.7% of all residential borrowers out of their homes. Obama says create a new federal housing administration. Ask lenders to write down loans to more conventional borrowers. Close the bankruptcy loophole for mortgage companies. Create a new mortgage interest tax credit and undo the bankruptcy reform, so-called, that was recently done, and more tightly regulate lenders. Pretty straightforward stuff. McCain's position, it's hard to say. He's been all over the map on this, but by and large, he's a deregulator. Excessive executive incomes. Close the tax loopholes that basically subsidize executive pay. And this is pretty straightforward stuff. And by the way, I would say let's restore the income tax, not to the 35% that we had under Clinton, but to the 91% we had under Eisenhower. I want the Eisenhower tax rate back. It worked fine under the Republican Eisenhower. It worked fine under Richard Nixon. Let's have back, well, under Nixon, actually, that was the post-Kennedy. That was 74%. That's fine, too. You know, 70%, 90%, one or the other for people making over $3.2 million. Then we could deal with some of this absurd executive income and this extreme inequality. Offshoring and trade policies that fail families. You already know my thoughts on this. We need to go back to a rational tariff system and trade system. We need to pull out a NAFTA, CAFTA, AFTA, and you fill in the blank. If it's got FTA at the end of it, we're out of it, and bail out of the WTO too, and say sorry, you don't run our country anymore. You transnational corporations. Our deteriorating infrastructure, the American Society of Civil Engineers, $1.6 trillion to deal with things like the Northeast blackout of 2003, the New Orleans levee system, the collapse of I-35 in Minnesota, and all these other problems. And by the way, it would put people to work. How about equal pay? Expand enforcement of the Equal Pay Act between men and women. Paid family leave and workplace flexibility. You know, the United States is the only industrialized country in the world, to the extent that you can still call us industrialized, that doesn't provide workers with paid maternity or paternity leave. Raise the minimum wage. It's worth right now 20% less than it was in 1979. And it should be jacked up by, in my opinion, at least 50%. Taxes and deficits. We need to raise taxes and pay down our deficits. This is absolutely nuts. It's absolutely nuts the way things are running. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First, I'd like to give you some experiences as a corporate whistleblower. But you were talking about the bailout bill and how, you know, our government's buying banks. Now, in accordance with the bankruptcy bill, not only are we buying banks, we're buying stock in companies.
Right.
We're redistributing, you know, debt to foreign banks, and we're extending financing to foreign banks to purchase that debt. I mean, this is ridiculous. And I'm meeting with Congressman Ellison on Monday to go over his support of this. But
yeah, this it actually may be, Mark, that over the short term, the actual best solution with regard to the banks is to buy the banks, the Swedish solution. I'm really impressed, actually, that the doctrinaire conservatives are actually considering the liberal socialist solution to the banking crisis. But the banking crisis is a symptom. It's not a cause. And they're dealing with a symptom. It's like
exactly. They're
yelling at the thermometer because it says that the fever's 103. And now they're going to give aspirin to a cancer patient. And it's not going to work.
And that's what the true cause of this was: lack of regulation, lack of oversight, deregulation, and lack of accountability for those people committing the fraud.
Absolutely.
And
plus, they did away with the stat tax, the securities transaction tax, and so it lubricated the system. It made it much easier to gamble in this gambling market.
Right. And after Enron, you know, Congress passed Sarbanes-Oxley. That was supposed to be this epic corporate governance reform. How many whistleblowers have you heard of that have, you know, been able to step forward that, you know, were willing to expose this corporate
threat? The Bush administration has been cracking down on whistleblowers.
They've been
refusing to enforce the protections for whistleblowers.
Absolutely. And here we just had a Petters corporation. A whistleblower came forward, and the only reason she really came forward is because they were about to be exposed, and she came forward to be able to cut a deal. And this had been going on for years. And this was a $3 billion investment fraud. It wasn't Sarbanes-Oxley. It wasn't the SEC that uncovered this. You know, it was the fact that they were about to get caught.
Right. Yeah, and that's the bottom line. And we need to actually, even for those who are about to get caught, we need to have better protections. Mark, thank you very much. But, this is, you can track this all back to the ideology of Ronald Reagan. It just all goes right back to that point. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. And our, congratulations. We caught you doing something right here. I'll just let this ad speak for itself. Yeah, this is an ad about Michelle Bachmann, who is the Republican congresswoman from Minnesota. And it helps if I turn on the volume.
Bachmann and George Bush are very close. Very close. In Congress, Bachmann voted with Bush 89% of the time. Four Bush's tax breaks for millionaires. Four Bush's tax breaks for big oil. But middle-class families got jilted. Bachmann voted against a middle-class tax cut, against raising the minimum wage, and even said we should eliminate it. Tell Michelle Bachmann to stop kissing up to Bush and stand up for working families.
This is paid for by the Alliance for a Better Minnesota. This is not a campaign ad. And if you go over to dumpbachmann.blogspot.com, Bachmann and Palin in 2012, people are saying, oh, yeah, that's what we need. Well, Bob Olson, I believe, is the guy running against Michelle Bachmann. And if I'm right, it's bobolson.org is his website. Just thought you might want to know. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Rob, speaking of Minnesota, hey, Rob, what's up?
Guess what? Al Franken is in the lead up here.
Yeah, so I saw on the front page of the New York Times today.
You know, I've donated to his campaign liberally, but the whole thing is some of the letters I sent him weren't quite so proper, but at the same time, I told him what I was thinking of. I'm glad to hear it. You know, I took and I gave you about a year and a half ago my the conservative mind theory as far as the half-brain theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where, right now, I was listening to Hannity yesterday afternoon, and it's where they are getting really kind of frantic right now because they're trying to prove this terrorist thing.
Right.
And it's not going very far, I don't think, because John Corzine was on his program yesterday, and it came down to the point where, you know, yes. But everybody else is, what you know, let's face it, the economy, I already lost $15,000 in the last couple months.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to be able to take and try and get their point across when they're talking about terrorists compared to the economy? There's no way, you know. I mean, they have gone down this road so many times before as far as their distractions. Don't you think it's about time that it was where they talked about the things that are really going on out here?
Well, that's the problem. They can't talk about the things that are really going on out here, Rob, because they caused these disasters. And that's why they're doing everything they can to say, be afraid, terrorist, terrorist. Oh, look out. Oh, is that a black guy? Holy cow. You know, they're doing that. That's their shtick, and that's all they've got, and expect it to get far, far worse over the next 4 weeks. No. Thank you, Rob, for the call. Alex in Atlanta. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Tom. I just want to say first that I love listening to your program. This is the first time I've called in. I just had a question. This whole terrorist thing, can it be looked at as like libel or slander towards?
No, you can't libel or slander a public figure. You can say if somebody puts themselves into the public light like that, you can say pretty much anything about them, and they can't, sue back. Like a private individual actually has the ability to do that,
okay,
but not a public figure.
I'm new to politics. I'm only 23, and I didn't know how that worked.
No, all they can do is just say it ain't true, you know, and push back, which I think that they've done fairly well, you know, as Barack Obama pointed out. Yeah, Bill Ayers did some detestable stuff when I was 8 years old. Excuse me. Let's look at Michelle and thank you, Alex, for the call. Let's look at Ms. Palin's husband's record, Todd, who was a member of the Alaska Independence Party, which is calling for secession from the Union. I mean, the last time a state did that, as I recall, the President of the United States declared war on them. Or maybe it was the other way around, but you get the point. I mean, do we really want somebody who is advocating essentially a new civil war to be the husband of the Vice President of the United States? It's totally bizarre. Alex in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Alex, listening on Sirius.
Hi.
What's up?
Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, they're going to nationalize the banks, the Citibank. Isn't Big Dick Cheney on the board of directors there?
I doubt he is right now. I think that when he became vice president, he had to bail out of all those kinds of things. But if you go over to
Halliburton, too, I would imagine, right?
Yeah. If
I
you
think
go over
he's still
to,
got his fingers in there.
Yep, the website for that stuff, but you know, if he's not on the board now, he will be when he leaves office. Alex, thank you very much for pointing that out. Go to theyrule.net, theyrule.net. And I know most things are .com, .org. This is .net, theyrule.net. And it's a really great little site if you want to see who's on the board of what and how they're interconnected. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Wonderful website. Sean in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Beloved leader Paulson hired some little minion 35-year-old guy, and guess who he used to work for? Goldman Sachs. He's gonna administer the TARP program. Am I being naive to think that, you know, on the day they carry out the first TARP transaction, that the FBI and the Justice Department is gonna swoop down on Goldman Sachs headquarters? I mean, by the way, Tom.
Yeah, you are being naive. It ain't gonna happen.
Tom, could you hit me with one of those Ownership Society quotes again? The McCain campaign is just going off with this Fannie and Freddie stuff. But, I mean, can you imagine the economic growth in our country if it hadn't been for the 50% of mortgages that were handled by Freddie and Fannie? I mean, they were all over the Ownership Society, and now they're running away from it as fast as they can.
Yeah, and go back. You know, I've gotten a bunch of emails from people. In fact, I was going to read it during the segment, but the segment kind of got away from me. Go back and just Google Elliot Spitzer in Washington Post.
Okay.
And find his op-ed in the Washington Post where a year ago Elliot Spitzer was talking about how all of the attorneys general of the United States, all of them got together and petitioned the Bush administration to let them enforce laws against predatory lending and against the corruption of the mortgage process. And the Bush administration pulled out of their hat a Civil War era law to prevent states from enforcing their own laws regulating banks.
Well, and these are the same guys who were against unions for the last 30 years. They were against public housing for the last 30 years. They promoted the Ownership Society, and now they're saying, you know, oh, that wasn't us. That was the Democrats. I mean, they're just shameless.
And they're spending a pile of money on it. They've got a whole bunch of, one of the think tanks out there has funded a bunch of people to go through thousands of hours of C-SPAN to find a small group of by coincidence, African-American, yeah, right, a coincidence, African-American Democrats saying, oh, yeah, Fannie and Freddie are fine.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, so here it is. It's starting to bleed through into the corporate media. Welcome back to the second hour of our program, my friends. My friends. I think of you as my friends. So. Tenza Ian Urbina writing in today's New York Times. You can find this on the front page of the electronic edition, nytimes.com. I'm assuming it's on the front page of the physical edition as well. I'll just share with you a couple of selected sentences from this article by Ian in today, October 9, 2008, New York Times. Tens of thousands of eligible voters in at least six swing states have been removed from the rolls or have been blocked from registering in ways that appear to violate federal law. Ian suggests this may not be being done by a political party, but notes, because Democrats have been more aggressive at registering new voters this year, any heightened screening of new applications may affect their party. According to state election officials, any heightened screening of new applications may affect their party's supporters disproportionately. The screening or trimming of voter registration lists in the six states, Colorado, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Nevada, and North Carolina, could also result in problems at the polls on Election Day. Some states allow such voters to cast provisional ballots, but they are often not counted because they require added verification. Remember, there were over 100,000 provisional ballots that went uncounted, over 130,000, as I recall, in Ohio in 2004. Although much attention this year has been focused on the millions of new voters being added to the rolls by the candidacy of Senator Barack Obama, there has been far less notice given to the number of voters being dropped from those same rolls, writes Ian Urbina in today's New York Times. In fact, Ian writes, for every voter added to the rolls in the past 2 months in some states, for every voter added to the rolls, election officials have removed two, a review of the records show. The six swing states seem to be in violation of federal law in two ways. Michigan and Colorado are removing voters from the rolls within 90 days of a federal election, which is not allowed except when voters die, notify the authorities they've moved out of state, or have been declared unfit to vote. Indiana, Nevada, North Carolina, and Ohio seem to be improperly using Social Security data to verify registration applications for new voters. Three more states appear to be violating federal law, Alabama and Georgia, improperly using Social Security information. Louisiana removed thousands of voters after the federal deadline for taking such action. And then they get into some of the details, and it's truly mind-boggling. Election officials in Nevada, for example, this is the state where they just busted Acorn because there were 40-some-odd funky, you know, Dallas Cowboy, whatever, people registering to vote, and Acorn, by the way, had flagged those and said, we think there's something wrong with these. So they took them out. In the year ending September 30, election officials in Nevada, for example, used the Social Security database more than 740,000 times to check voter files or registration applications and found more than 715,000 non-matches, federal records show. Election officials in Georgia ran more than 1.9 million checks on voter files or voter registration applications and found more than 260,000 non-matches. Doing this, by the way, is a violation of federal law. In three states, that's me, not the New York Times speaking, but they say the data seemed to represent a violation of federal law and the contract the state signed with the agency to use the database. In three states... Now, this is mind-boggling. In three states, Colorado, Louisiana, and Michigan, the number of people purged from the election roll since August 1st far exceeds the number who have died or relocated during that time period. For example, major voter registration drives have been held this year in Colorado, which also has a significant population increase since the last presidential election, but the state has recorded a net loss of nearly 100,000 voters from its rolls since 2004. You think you're registered to vote? Good luck. That's the New York Times. That's the New York Times. Now, keep in mind, the McCain campaign has now gone 100% negative 100% of the time. The Obama campaign, on the other hand, is running some startlingly positive, some you know, really... nicely positive messages. For example, this is one of Obama's new campaign ads, and I think it's just absolutely brilliant. It's one of several.
Barack Obama, and I approve this message. One of my earliest memories, going with my grandfather to see some of the astronauts being brought back after a splashdown, sitting on his shoulders and waving a little American flag. And my grandfather, you know, would say, "Oh, boy, Americans, we can do anything when we put our minds to it."
His grandfather fought in Patton's army. His grandmother worked on a bomber assembly line. But it was his mother who would see in him a promise.
my mother, she said to herself, you know, my son, he's an American, and he needs to understand what that means. She'd wake me up at 4:30 in the morning, and we'd sit there and go through my lessons, and I used to complain and grumble. And she'd say, well, this is no picnic for me either, Buster.
His life was shaped by the values he learned as a boy.
Hard work, honesty, self-reliance, respect for other people, kindness, faith. That's the country I believe in.
That's the new Obama ad. And yet the reason the McCain campaign is going 100% negative is because negative advertising, the main goal of negative advertising is not to cause people to vote for you to stop the other guy. In other words, the McCain campaign is not running a negative campaign because they want people to vote for McCain out of fear of Obama. They're running a negative campaign because they know that all the studies, this is no secret in politics, all the studies show that what negative campaigning does is it drives down the total number of voters. It causes people to just say, to hell with all of it. I got an email this morning from an old friend back Michigan days saying, you know, I am so sick and tired of all this negative campaigning on both sides. I just don't know what to do. I mean, it's essentially. And that's what happens when the negative campaigning on one side is so relentless. It seems to bleed across, and people just say, ah, they're all crooks. This is a flyer that was distributed, that was you know, carpet bombed across Philadelphia, across black neighborhoods in Philadelphia. Mark Crispin Miller sent me a copy of it. I have the actual flyer here. And it's written like a letter. It says, recently at school, an Obama supporter approached me during a Rock the Vote assembly. He informed that on the day of the election, there will be undercover officers to execute warrants on those who come to vote based on the anticipated turnout. He advised me that if I had any outstanding warrants or traffic offenses, I should clear them up prior to voting. They assume this to be an opportunity for those who normally go by, take names and addresses to give their real names and IDs, allowing them to place name and face together, and voila, gotcha, arrested on the spot. So all you have to do, so if you have one or the other, take care of it. Due to the electronic genius of wireless technology, this can and will take place all across the nation from L.A. to New York. Why hasn't this been done before? This seems like a great way to arrest or just be able to identify criminals in the area. I applaud the new efforts of local and state authorities and hope to see a great success rate. I'm sorry, but I don't think they should be able to vote anyway. Question, are convicted felons allowed to vote? He also said, this is this mythical friend, that both Obama and McCain support this idea, but that he, Obama, does not want the public to see any of his supporters get locked up showing their support or illegally voting for him. An incentive to avoid the legal dilemma, but that still participating in the vote is being put into place. This would allow individuals to turn themselves in prior to voting without legal penalty. This type of incentive recently took place in South Philadelphia Church with an outstanding turnout. Is this taking away the true freedom of voting? Is this legal? We've also learned that at the polling sites, local authorities will not only be checking for scofflaw traffic ticket offenders inside, but will also take place outside. There will be vehicles equipped with plate identification computers. Upon identification, cars will be locked with an immobilization feature, locked on its tire, and then towed. I think this November will be a November to remember. I love technology. Signed, Anonymous. Hundreds of thousands of these things in the black community in Philadelphia and happening all over the United States. Meanwhile, in Missouri officials, because Acorn has turned in 135 questionable cards, 85 of them duplicates, that by and large Acorn had flagged. Officials in Missouri are freaking out and they're saying, oh my God, we've got election fraud. Because Limbaugh is going after Acorn every single day. This is the whole Republican meme is drive down the vote. This is all about drive down the vote. And it's getting even stranger in states like Nevada, where the Secretary of State is a Democrat. Let me tell you about that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Noon to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific, Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. All right, it's weird. It's downright weird. A man in Michigan assigned The Crucible. Remember that old play about the Salem witch trials? In an adult education class, doused his teacher with a non-flammable liquid and threatened to burn her as a witch, police said. Darren Nager, 20, ran from the classroom after the attack September 11th and was sent for psychiatric evaluation after telling police he was trying to kill the witch by pouring holy water over her head. Nobody has confirmed whether or not he is affiliated with the witch doctor who anointed Sarah Palin. Yes, that actually happened. The guy drove the witches out of Kenya. Anyhow, Ross Miller, the Secretary of State in Nevada, is not a Republican. He's a Democrat, which somewhat complicates this story about Acorn being raided in Nevada. I got an email here from Mark Crispin Miller, an old friend and an activist in these areas. MarkCrispinMiller.blogspot.com is his blog. He says, that is, the raid on Acorn would appear to represent a blow against Obama, not by the Republicans, but by the centrist or old guard Democratic apparatus in the state. That machine supported Hillary Clinton in the primary some months ago. To get some sense of how her supporters feel about the raid on Acorn, check out what they're posting at HillaryClintonForum.net. And so I thought, well, you know, all right. And in fact, we're Sue is cleaning up the URL. It's we're going to have it at the top of TomHartman.com. This link, this is the Hillary Clinton Forum, independent discussion forum for supporters of Hillary Clinton. HFC, by the way, is 100% independent and has no affiliation with Hillary Clinton. They write up at the very top. So let's be very clear about this. These are the supporters of Hillary Clinton, not Hillary Clinton herself. So this long thread about Acorn office raided in voter fraud starts out. Sandy in PA, the moderator, posts the story. Nevada state authorities are raiding the Las Vegas headquarters of an organization that works to get low-income people to vote. And then Mary says, I hope they find something that goes back to the primary. That would be indicative of what went on there and maybe lead them to start looking about at other places. About damn time. And then M. Joy Naples writes, good looking into this and hopefully stopping it before anything else goes awry. And then Scott V.A. says, this should go beyond a state-level investigation, go federal, and include all state chapters of Acorn. Time to bust up this bogus group. And then Country First posts, Acorn is driving me nuts. Go get them, feds. And then Mary, the moderator, posts, me too. I'll never look at an oak tree the same way again. And then another one person says, yippee, I want many more Acorn offices about to be raided, too. I hope that many more. And then Ragdoll says, they need to get to the root of Acorn. This organization is run by a bunch of squirrely rodents. Well, that's funny. And then JustMy.02, hallelujah, I just sent on Sunday our Acorn fact sheet and a link to Hillary's campaign complaint to the publisher of the Las Vegas Review-Journal in response to a column he wrote about voter fraud in Nevada. While it appears that there's been an ongoing investigation there, maybe it will trigger other investigations in other states. And it goes on. Hot damn, Southern Knights says, finally, democracy at work. And Let's Help America says, you're totally right on this. If they cheated in Nevada, they cheated elsewhere. And then Susan from PA, amen. I hope it comes out that Obama stole the election from Hillary. People need to see this blazed across as big headlines. And then Writer Chick, a moderator, says, wait until the caucus fraud investigations start. The House of Cards will come tumbling down. And then Andy Licious writes, this is great, but we need to get each state to act separately. This is not a federal-type investigation. If it were federal, wouldn't that be great? 50 or 100 Acorn offices raided simultaneously. And then Florida Dem posts, the feds need to shake a mighty oak so that all the acorns come tumbling down. And then Sugar and Spice's mom writes, I was at the McCain headquarters and they announced this. McCain camp went wild, cheering and clapping. It was great to see the enthusiasm. Of course, I had to put in my 2 cents and told the campaign manager they need to keep hitting hard at the Acorn-Obama connection. And then T. Toad posts to the Hillary Clinton forum.net. This needs to be done nationwide. I can't even imagine how many homeless in Ohio are voting for Obama. And then Denver 2006 posts, it's not only how many homeless are voting for BO, it's also how many times in different locations they're voting. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and gets even You know, just imagine all the fraud that's been going on all along, posts Puma, Let's Help America. And then Bill Demo posts, hopefully there'll be an investigation in Acorn's offices all across the U.S. These are folks who believe, and I think, you know, sincerely believe, that Hillary Clinton was robbed of the election by shenanigans that perhaps involved the quick registration of people by Acorn, other groups like this. And they're just, they're going gung-ho with John McCain. I'm just, it boggles my mind. It just boggles my mind. So here we have, you know, a concerted effort across the United States to suppress the vote, incredible negative campaigning, and former Hillary Clinton supporters getting on board. Bill and Hillary, speak out against this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. All righty, here it comes. I'm telling you. You'll recall George W. Bush said...
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, it requires, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. It's important for our fellow citizens to understand, when you think Patriot Act, constitutional guarantees are in place when it comes to doing what is necessary to protect our homeland, because we value the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. Our civil liberties, they're intact. Nothing to worry about, my friends. Everything's just fine. However, ABC says, the NSA frequently listened to and transcribed the private phone calls of Americans abroad. This is from ABC News. Former Navy Arab linguist David Murphy Falk says he and others in his section of the NSA facility at Fort Gordon routinely shared salacious or tantalizing phone calls that had been intercepted, alerting office mates to certain time codes of cuts that were available on each operator's computer. Hey, check this out, Falk says, he would be told. There's a good phone sex. Or there's some pillow talk. Pull up this call. It's really funny. Go check it out. It would be some colonel making pillow talk, and we'd say, wow, this is crazy, Falk told ABC News. We knew they were working for these aid organizations, former Army Reserves Arab linguist Andrian Keen told ABC News. They were identified in our systems as belongs to the International Red Cross and all these other organizations. And yet, instead of blocking these phone numbers, we continued to collect on them, she told ABC News. Yeah. We're only tracking phone calls of known Al-Qaeda suspects. Yeah. And isn't it entertaining to listen to them as they work for the Red Cross, having a intimate conversation with their husband or wife or friend or whatever? Amazing. Well, no, actually it's not. It's absolutely not. 866-303-2270, Ed in Hillsborough, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Listen, just follow up real quick on that story about Acorns and the supposed Hillary discussion board. I think that you're totally misreading what that actually is. I think that that's probably some kind of a phony baloney Republican discussion board that was put up to pose as a front for pro-Hillary, anti-Obama people. And after that story had faded from the news cycle, the Republican McCain supporters that are on that thing continue to use it to talk to each other. So I think that's all that's going on there.
It's not inconceivable, Ed, but there is a whole, you know, the Hillary blogosphere, Larry Johnson's No Quarter. I mean, there's still a whole bunch of sites out there that may well be fronts for Republicans. Sure. I'm telling you, I know that they are sucking in Democrats. I know some of these people.
Right.
And you know, they believe that the election was stolen from them by Obama. They're cheering the idea of his going down, and they hate Acorn.
True enough, but I think we're talking about a small fringe group of, and I hate to use fringe because I've been called fringe myself, but
yeah.
We're not talking about a statistically significant group of people here.
And it may well be. It may well be. And I hope that Hillary Clinton will call them out and say, this is, you know, we're supportive of Acorn's efforts, and Barack Obama won fair and square. If she would simply say those things, it would shut down all this conversation. But
sure.
Those things have not, to the best of my knowledge, been said. Maybe I'm wrong. Somebody can correct me. But to the best of my knowledge, those things have not been said, and they need to be said. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Mary in Seattle. Hey, Mary.
Hello?
Hey, Mary, you're on the air.
Okay. Well, you know, first of all, I've got like a trio of things I'm hoping there'll be time to string together here. But
Mary, we got a whole bunch of people waiting on hold. What's your
point? Yeah, I'm in there a while too. Anyway, you decide. But the first thing I wanted to say is what you said earlier about looking like socialism by buying these banks and whatnot. Mm. Can you own the whole country already and you just decide to put your liabilities into the country and take them out of your company? I mean, it's really just like having a reverse trust. I mean, they own the country. What does it, you know? I don't think we're talking about socialism. I think we're talking about something else now. Now, what you're talking about when taking over the voting, if it's already so stacked as you've described today, then, you know, I'm already just pull the radio plug and pack it up and take off. I mean, there's no hope in this election, and this election was the last hope.
Yeah, well, let me say, Mary, the good news is that the New York Times outed this thing. And the bad news is that in Colorado, for example, where there's been huge voter registration efforts, there are fewer people registered to vote, 100,000 fewer people registered to vote right now than there were in 2004. That's very disheartening. Hopefully, these things can be reversed. If these are clear violations of federal law, and the New York Times asserts that they are, and the New York Times, I mean, is generally taken seriously by people who work for Secretary of State's offices, I think, frankly, we should be starting right now to be talking about prosecuting the people who are doing this, so that the other people around the country will stop and you know, put the fear of God in them. Sonny in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Sonny.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, maybe you can talk me, by the way, thank you for taking my call. Maybe you could talk me off the ledge, because there's three things that happened today that's really concerned me. Number one, Fox has got the drumbeat going constantly about this Acorn thing. Yeah. They just trumpet it all the time. And then also I watched MSNBC, and they were talking about the states that were purging the votes.
Right.
And guess what? They happen to be all battleground states.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Yes. And number three, also to trump this, Dana Perino announced today that there was a new executive order coming out of the president's office on a transition policy involving national security and so on and so on and so on. Very troubling. It's very scary.
Yeah, we'll have to look for that executive order. Thanks for the heads up on that, Sonny. And all of these things, you know, the one thing that they want you and me to do is say, oh, my God, it's gone to hell in a handbasket. I'm not even going to bother to vote. That's what they want us to say. And it is the wrong thing to say. So, number one, check your voter registration. Make sure that you are registered to vote. Check with your Secretary of State's office and make sure you're registered to vote. Let me just double-check the website here. I think it's canivote.org. Yes, canivote.org. The National Secretaries of State put this website up, National Association of Secretaries of State. And, you know, for some states, it's really, really nice and it's really efficient. Other states, it's a start. But make sure that you're registered to vote. Don't let them take your vote away. And then show up. Volunteer with the local Democratic Party, volunteer with the local campaign offices, whatever it may be, Democracy for America, drinking liberally, show up and take the day off, election day off on November 4th, Tuesday, November 4th, and, you know, put in advance for a sick day or whatever it may be, so that you can drive people to the polls, so you can be a poll watcher, so you can be a poll worker. Let's us get out there and take back this process. I just don't see any other alternative. Diane in Carson, California. Hey, Diane.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I received a call from my sister who lives in Oklahoma City, and she decided to become an absentee voter, And when she received her ballot, she was reading the instructions to mark her ballot, and it said that she had to mark her ballot with a number 2 pencil. Obviously, this gave her some concern. She called and told me about it. I suggested that she call her election official and find out if she, because, you know, the ballot could be erased, anything. It could be compromised.
Right.
When she
Plus,
called
not
them,
a lot of people have number 2 pencils hanging around these days. You know?
Right. So she called the election official, and they told her, well, yes, you have to mark it with a number 2 pencil, because if you mark it in ink, and perhaps you could use black ink, our machines may not be able to read your ballot.
Right.
What options does she have?
She's going to have to get a number 2 pencil. They're using the scan machines that, shine a little bit of light on the ballot. And if you use ink that has a shininess to it, mm-hmm. it reflects that light back, and the thing doesn't read it as being darkened. It reads it as being lightened. And, you know, I'm familiar with this. This is a problem that they had with this technology like 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And I'm just boggled that they're still using optical scan machines that can't read an ink-filled-out absentee ballot. But, it's
Is it possible, are they having to do that even if she decided to go to the polls?
Yeah, but see, when you go to the polls, they give you a pencil.
Okay.
They just hand you the pencil, and they say, here's a pencil, and here's the ballot. Fill it out. So, you know, she needs to get a number 2 pencil. You know, I don't know any other solution. Thank you, Diane, for the call. I appreciate it. Michelle in San Diego. We got a minute before the break. Michelle, what's up?
Hi, Michelle. Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, you're the smartest man in America.
Thank you.
I love listening to you. I first wanted to say I love that you're talking about getting out the vote. I live in California, which is probably going to go to Barack Obama. And I've been registering voters on my own in front of a local pet store. You know, I registered 50 Democrats on Saturday and 17 on Sunday, and I've been at the community college and stuff. And I'm an official precinct leader, too. And so I have the list, and I have the ages of people who vote, and I'm just so discouraged, you know, when I look at 30 and under, you know, and how many elections they've voted in, and they just don't vote. I don't know if their parents make them register to vote, and then they just don't vote.
Yeah.
So discouraging. So please ask them to get out and vote.
Okay, great.
And
I'll do it.
Tell them that registering to vote is not going to give them jury duty. That's at the DMV.
Oh, yeah, that's getting a driver's
license.
That's
the DMV, because that's another reason. And I've also encountered a lot of racists, and I'm really discouraged about that, too, you know, that have been lifelong Democrats, but they won't vote for the – and they have used the N-word.
Yeah.
And I was in front of our local pet store – and they said, I have a little donkey on my jacket, and that's the only way anybody would know. And I'm registering everybody, but I have a little donkey. And he said, well, you're going to vote for Barack, aren't you? And I said, well, I'm not here to discuss politics. I'm just here to register voters. And he said, but you're going to vote for him. And he pursued me. And I said, yes, yes, yes. And so he stood in front of the store and told everybody going in the store I was voting for the N-word, and he used the word, and I had to walk away.
Yeah, this it's really tragic.
And he's not the only one.
No, I know. Michelle, thank you very much for sharing the news.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Another day.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Joining the fight by taking on the right. ABC News, this I shared the story with you earlier. Here's the actual audio. This is Brian Ross, Vic Walter, Anna Schechter. You can find it over at abcnews.go.com or the ABC News website. They're interviewing these guys who are listening in on our conversations.
Of American officers, mostly in the green zone, calling home to the United States, talking to their spouses and sometimes their girlfriends, sometimes on the same days.
It gets weirder. I'll share a little more of that with you in the next hour. Right now, Brad Friedman is with us. Brad, he's the publisher and editor of bradblog.com. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Just great. You've been doing a really, really fine job of keeping track of voter suppression and election fraud here in the United States over all these many years. And today the New York Times broke this story. I've been talking about it on the show here today. Also, you know, Acorn is being just beaten to death by the Reich. What's happening from your point of view?
Yeah, this is getting worse and worse. It's spreading right now like a virus. It would I'd suggest this would be a staged October surprise on behalf of the GOP. They are now spreading this voter fraud, this Acorn voter fraud scam into Missouri. And you'll note, of course, it's the swing states where all of this is happening. There was a raid in Vegas on Monday. And yesterday, Fox and Friends actually had a segment about both Nevada and suggesting there was something going on in Missouri. And incredibly, the Republican National Committee actually released the transcript from Fox and Friends as an official news release yesterday, just removing the middleman, I suppose, at this point, and dropping all pretense that Fox is anything, you know, but the RNC's media arm. And sure enough, late last night, AP had a story about Missouri, and in Kansas City, Jackson County in Missouri, you've got this election director, Charlene Davis. Now, you remember her. You had her on your show some weeks ago. She was the one who was instrumental in seeing the election integrity fella arrested for trying to cast his vote legally. Remember that?
Yeah.
She's now out there playing along with the GOP, saying there's this massive voter fraud going on by Acorn. Problem is, Acorn has not given any registrations to Jackson County, Missouri, since August. So all of a sudden, all of these news reports that are coming out that Acorn is, you know, burying them with fraudulent registrations is simply nonsense because they haven't given them any in months. And furthermore, what they never report in these Acorn stories is that it is actually Acorn themselves who is reporting the fraud. They confirm, they try to anyway, they try to authenticate every single registration that they get. And if they can't, you know, confirm the person on the form is who they say they are, they actually flag those as potentially fraudulent and give them to the election officials anyway, flagged that way, because they have to by law.
Now, what do you want to bet that part of the Steve Schmidt, Karl Rove campaign strategy for the McCain campaign is to intentionally disrupt voter registration drives by having people, by going to places where Acorn is doing voter registration and having people fraudulently register?
That they themselves are working to file these fraudulent registrations and then blowing the whistle on them.
Yeah.
You know, it would not surprise me at all, because this has been a scheme that has been, as you pointed out, I've been reporting on it now for years, since at least after the 2004 election, when they've been drawing out Acorn to be this boogeyman. It's
right.
Completely nonsense. It's a lie. It also happened, by the way, before the 2004 election, just days before the Ohio election, for example. They reported that Acorn had registered a terrorist to vote in Ohio, and of course they didn't. It was a completely made-up story. There was some terrorist who did end up registering at the DMV. It was caught. Acorn had nothing to do with it. But they are trying to cause chaos in every state possible between now and Election Day. You pointed out the New York Times story that they're purging thousands of voters. That, Tom, is going to be the November surprise when people show up and find out they're not registered to vote. I believe we're going to have absolute chaos on Election Day if things keep up at this rate. People must check to make sure they're registered. If they think they registered, if they voted in the primary, check again, because this is happening all over the country. I'll throw in one more. Montana, they had the GOP challenge 6,000 voters solely on the basis that they had moved within the last 18 months. Finally, the Democrats for Change stepped up, filed a lawsuit against that, and today a federal court judge absolutely spanked the Republicans for doing for challenging 6,000 voters on no basis other than they happen to live in Democratic counties. It's unbelievable what's going on, Tom.
Yeah, it truly is. And you can read all about it over at Brad Blog, B-R-A-D-B-L-O-G, just like it sounds, bradblog.com. Brad Friedman, thanks for the great work you're doing, Brad. Keep it up.
Much appreciated, Tom.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. After the break, Ellen Brown is going to drop by. She's the author of Web of Death. Let's dig a little bit into what, you know, how the whole financial world is coming unraveled.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Brown is on the line with us. She is the author of a book, The Web of Death, D-E-B-T, by Ellen Hodgson Brown, J.D., and also her website, webofdebt.com. It's where recently I discovered an extraordinary blog posting called It's the Derivative Stupid, or words to that effect, as I recall. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, I'd like to just revisit your It's the Derivatives post that I believe was a week or two old. Can you revisit that for us?
Yeah. The point of the article was that the whole crisis that we've had the $700 billion bailout for has been cast as being a subprime crisis, but that's not really it. That was the domino that is that threatened to collapse the whole system. Well, that it is collapsing the system, but what they're really worried about and what's really at stake is $180 trillion in derivatives outstanding for U.S. banks. That's actually a conservative figure. The Bank for International Settlements put the figure at over a quadrillion. That's a thousand trillion.
A thousand trillion or a million, right?
Yeah, that's
no. A trillion is a million. It would be we're getting into huge numbers here.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, 60 trillion is the gross domestic product of all the countries in the world.
Right.
So 180 trillion is three times that. I mean, you can't possibly bail out.
And that's just U.S. banks.
Right.
Three times the GDP of the entire planet. And then the thousand trillion is the number of all the derivatives out there.
Well, that was the number of trades. So that's not actually the existing derivatives. That's trading hands.
Right. Okay. So the existing derivatives are in the neighborhood of
180 is a figure I've heard, but then it's been said that J.P. Morgan alone has something like that. So nobody knows for sure because many of these are privately traded.
Right.
And then the credit default swaps are $62 trillion, and the credit default swaps are what are the immediate issue here because those are the things. Those are bets. Derivatives are basically just bets,
right,
but they're sold as a form of insurance.
Right.
So. In order to sell these very risky collateralized debt obligations that were all mixed with subprime,
they sold a bet along with it. You know, as they say, here, you can buy this subprime mortgage and we'll also sell you a bet that it won't go down, that being the credit default swap. And then there were derivatives based even on those. You can buy derivatives based on whether the weather is going to be bad or good.
Right.
And so it's like it's all this wild betting on just about everything. And we're talking about three times, just these bets held by American banks being three times the gross domestic product of the entire planet. And it's mind-boggling. In your blog today over at webofdebt.com, Ellen Brown, you talk about how, you know, signs that the economic egg is cracking. Are the U.S. $9 trillion debt right now. We're closing in on $11 trillion with the bailout.
Yeah, it's up to 10, yeah. It's over 10.
And if we hit, I mean, you know, $9 trillion debt, I think that we're paying something on the order of around $400 billion a year just in interest to service that debt. We're going to reach the point where it's going to be impossible for us to even cover the interest charges. At that point, what happens?
That's when the whole system collapses. But I think it's collapsing before that. I think it's collapsing right now. The reason they had to go into all these derivatives and the subprime is that the entire banking system is based on a fraud. It's a Ponzi scheme, and it's been going on for 300 years, and it's just reached the end of the – there are no more borrowers that can be sucked in at the bottom to support the lenders at the top.
And the Ponzi scheme is basically these privatized federalized banks.
Right. The scheme, if you want to call it that, is that all of our money is created as a debt to a bank, except for coins, which are 1/1000th of the money supply. So the problem is that they create credit or debt, they create the principal, but they don't create the interest. And so in order to pay the debt back, somebody somewhere has to be taking out yet another loan, continually expanding the money supply and continually expanding the debt. If you look at charts of the national debt and charts of the national money supply, they look about the same. I mean, they're both going up exponentially, and they're both about to take off at that point where they just shoot up.
Because the only way to pay back the interest is to create new debt, and as you create new debt, you create new money supply, because our money supply is a function of, you know, every time a loan is taken out, money is created. This is the fractional reserve system.
Right.
Or fractional banking system, rather, the put into place by the Federal Reserve. And there are equivalents to the Federal Reserve all over the world, and this thing is now coming unraveled. It sounds like cancer, frankly. I mean, you know, it's unlimited growth. The cells don't stop growing. That's called cancer in biological systems. So we're talking with Ellen Brown, her website, webofdebt.com, her book, Web of Debt, The Web of Debt, D-E-B-T. How do you expect this to play out?
Well, I just saw today that Henry Paulson is considering, there is buried in that $700 billion bailout plan, originally what they're talking about was buying assets of the bank that were unmarketable. Well, they call them assets, but they're really liabilities. They're these derivatives. What you hear discussed on TV is the subprime mortgages, but that's not really what they're talking about. Subprime mortgages have a market value. What is unmarketable are these derivatives, and that's what they actually want to get off their books by turning them into good U.S. securities, because a derivative is very risky, and therefore it has a high capital requirement, whereas U.S. securities are considered risk-free.
So we buy them from the bank and give them treasuries in exchange for them.
Right. So my guess is they weren't even planning to fund this $700 billion. I mean, they're not actually going to put those bonds out to the Chinese or whoever comes along to buy them. They're going to actually take the bonds, deliver them to the Federal Reserve, and then the Federal Reserve will swap them for this very toxic collateral of the bank.
Right.
But that obviously wasn't working. I mean, the market's been collapsing this week. That was supposed to encourage everybody on increasing lending.
Mm-hmm.
But today what they're reporting is that Paulson is reconsidering and thinking about another option that's in the plan to actually buy equity of the banks.
Right. In other words, nationalize the banks like the British are doing right now.
Well, that's what I think should be done. But the problem is buying equity doesn't really – you could buy a portion of the equity.
Right. If you buy 5%, it doesn't matter. If you buy 90% or over 50%,
right,
it does matter.
Right.
It makes a big difference. And I've been an advocate for a long time of nationalizing the Fed.
And
just bringing the ability to create our money into our government rather than having I think it was Congressman Peter DeFazio on this show said that the Fed is more than 30% of the Fed is actually owned by people who don't even live in the United States and aren't U.S. citizens. It's you know, pretty startling.
I don't think that's actually true. It's owned by banks.
It's owned by the member
banks. All the banks are U.S. banks.
Right, but who owns the stock in the member banks?
Well, that's true, but that if they own more than 5%, they have to be reported, and there really aren't any huge foreign
investors. There aren't. Okay, well, that's good to know. That's good to know.
But I think it actually is controlled from abroad. The Bank for International Settlements is the banker's bank, the central banker's bank. Mm-hmm. It's in Switzerland, and that's the bank that imposed the capital requirement, the 8% capital requirement, and that's the reason that we have a credit freeze, because nobody can meet that capital requirement. Now, if you were actually a government bank, or if the Fed were actually a national institution, and if it owned a series of national banks, actually federal banks, they could issue credit directly. They don't have to have.
Is this not what Alexander Hamilton was recommending and pushing so hard, and Jefferson was pushing back against so hard, and Andrew Jackson ran against? Or do I have that backwards?
Well, I think what went wrong with the Constitution is that the founders were so afraid to even mention who had the power to issue money that they totally left it out. And so Hamilton, I mean, he did get us into this whole fractional reserve, private central banking system, but he really had no choice because, I mean, he did what he had to do because the government was heavily in debt. There were farmers and soldiers outside the Constitutional Convention rioting, wanting their money, and there was nothing to pay them with. And so Hamilton had to resort to this ruse where he would, where the government would borrow from a bank that supposedly was issuing banknotes that were backed by gold. But of course, they had far less gold than they were issuing notes. And the gold came from the government in the first place. It was the government's gold. But it was all sleight of hand to make it look like there was something backing these paper notes. And everybody accepted that, and it worked.
We're talking with Ellen Brown. She's the author of Web of Debt, her website, webofdebt.com. Ellen, I have just one more question for you. We've got to take a break. Can you stick around for a minute?
Yeah, sure.
I just want to ask you, you may be thinking about this during the break, although I'm sure you have it right at the tip of your tongue. What do you expect to happen? What are we going to see, and how's it going to affect the average person over the next 12, 18, 24, 36 months? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Congress on the minimum wage and see how long they can last. Let them try to rely on the minimum wage and see them change it, rearrange it while real fast. And when they say, but the pay makes it tough to survive, we're telling them, hey, it keeps you alive. When they cry that they try, but they can't get ahead, we'll send a social worker to pat them on the head. They'd be poor, but I'm sure it would be all the rage if we put Congress on the minimum wage.
No, it's a pretty good idea, actually. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Brown with us, the author of The Web of Debt. Ellen Hodgson Brown. Web of Debt, DEBT.com, her website. And Ellen, the question, you've done a brilliant analysis of our banking system, and your book is one of the best educations of it. Your website and your blogs are brilliant. Your thoughts on what we should expect to see over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and over the short term and over the near long term, I guess.
Well, I think things will get worse before they get better, but I tend to be an optimist. I think that's what you have to do in order to change the system.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be looking for another Roosevelt to come up with a new deal. And what Roosevelt did was, actually it was Hoover who set up the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Right. Actually, it was Congress who set it up.
Was it? Okay.
It was
under Hoover. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what they tried to do was the same thing that Paulson's trying to do now, which is to bail out the banks, and that didn't work.
Right.
So then what Roosevelt did was he took that same mechanism of a government institution with the power to lend, and gave credit to businesses and to housing. There was the home.
Right, directly to individuals. Yeah.
Yeah, and
he built it
worked.
From the bottom up rather than what they tried doing. And in fact, Congress in 1932 passed a $1.3 billion
bill to fund the Reconstruction Finance Administration, and it contained money that went to homeowners, it contained money that went to small businesses, it contained money that went to states in block grants so that they could do reconstruction projects. It contained the seeds of the CCC and whatnot, and Herbert Hoover vetoed it. And that was in the summer of 1932. And so when Roosevelt came into office, he just took that same legislation and didn't veto it. And it worked. It worked. But it didn't get rid of our fractional banking system, our fractional reserve system.
Right. Well, I think Roosevelt was afraid to actually change the whole system. But it does need, I mean, we've just demonstrated now that it doesn't work to keep that private system in place. You have to, credit is, our money only is the full faith and credit of the United States. It's properly issued by the United States. Most people think it is issued by the government, and they blame the government for everything that's gone wrong. But it's not really the government's fault not directly, because the government doesn't issue the money. It has to borrow the money from the Federal Reserve, which is privately owned, and which is actually just it protects its own banking club. The bankers get so many advantages that nobody else gets.
Yeah.
They can borrow at the 2% federal funds rate, and then they can turn around and buy 30-year U.S. bonds at 4.5%, and they get that spread for nothing. There was a freeze on...
They make money just by living.
Yeah.
Just by existing. I'm sorry. You said there was a freeze on...
There was a freeze on short selling the banks, and I mean, every other business has been complaining for years that they've been destroyed by short selling and by naked short selling, and nobody does anything about it. But the bankers get this special favored treatment. The reason being that we think that we have to have the private banking system in order to have a credit system, but we don't. It misconstrues the nature of credit. They don't have any money what they lend us is not money. It's merely credit. And the government could do that better than a private banking system.
Do you think there's any possibility, Ellen Brown, that what will come out of this crisis, first of all, that there could be a default by the United States government, and secondly, whether there is or whether there isn't, that we could see the end of the Fed?
I don't think there'll be a default. Unlike Russia or Argentina or in any other country that was heavily in debt, we have the power to issue dollars. So all they have to do is issue the dollars to pay off their debts.
So now, we could have a hyperinflation.
Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be easy, but it wouldn't be an outright default.
Right.
Yeah, hyperinflation is likely, or... the dollar would be abandoned. But they could actually do that slowly. In fact, they're doing that now. You know, when nobody else buys the bonds, U.S. bonds, which is our debt, then they get bought by these mysterious banks down in the Cayman Islands that are, who knows, financial institutions of some sort, hedge funds or something, to buy up the bonds, taking up the apparent loss on them. So it is thought that these are actually agents of the U.S. I mean, this is part of the plunge protection team system.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this sounds like plunge protection stuff. The federal government is basically backstopping itself. But that's not buying the Fed. That's just buying our own debt.
Right, but you were talking about a national default.
Right.
And yeah, I think they'll have to nationalize the Federal Reserve, but what it will take is some more understanding of what the whole system is.
Right, and I have a horrible feeling it's going to take a whole lot more pain, too, before we get there.
Yeah.
We shall see. Ellen Hodgson Brown, J.D., her book, The Web of Debt, webofdebt.com, the website. Ellen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Yeah, that's where she went. Off to Alaska. Christy Harvey with us.
the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.com, the website. And Christy, how's Alaska treating you?
I actually love it so far. It's snowing right now. When I went to take the trash out this morning, there were two moose just sort of wandering around the apartment complex. It's new and different and strange, but I kind of like it so far.
That's great.
It's definitely Palin country, though. That's hard to get used to.
Oh, really? You've seen a lot of bumper stickers and signs and things?
A lot of bumper stickers, my favorite one of which is Alaska, coldest state, hottest governor.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, so that's the big one. So that's I just keep my head down and keep on keeping on.
Yeah, there you go. Just to get through some of the news here today, what you do with us is the news that has slid under the radar here, and you catch it and pass it back to us. I played a little bit of the audio from these two intelligence officials at ABC News. This is a report that's really worth checking out. ABC News interviewed. Give us the quick summary.
Well, Tom, I think this is really, really striking because it's what you and I have really been afraid of ever since we heard about these warrantless wiretaps. And it turns out our deepest fears are actually coming true. When they talked about wiretapping Americans who were talking to their friends either overseas or when we were overseas talking to friends and family back in the States, we were told, you know, don't worry about it. George Bush said, you know, we're not going to be listening in for fun. This is only to catch terrorists. But two separate, different NSA officials who were not connected to each other in the least have come forward and said actually the opposite is true. And there was one, a Navy linguist, a guy named David Falk, and he said that he and his buddies listened into hundreds of Americans using phones from Baghdad back into the States, and it would be, you know, soldiers talking to their girlfriends back home or women talking to their husbands back home, and they would actually listen and flag, you know, the quote-unquote good parts when things got interesting or sexy or something, and pass the tapes around so that other people could listen to them and laugh or enjoy it or listen in on these private phone conversations. And then another woman came forward and said that not only were we listening in on, you know, just normal conversations, but the NSA was actually targeting people like the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders and other humanitarian groups that are supposed to enjoy special standing and are supposed to, you know, not have to worry about the U.S. government listening in on their conversations.
Right. So they lied to us again. Frankly, this is something that I just sort of routinely expected. The thing that I'm the most concerned about is that they're listening in on the conversations of U.S. senators and members of Congress.
Yes.
That they're listening in on the conversations of anti-war protesters and activists, that they're, or even forget anti-war, that they're listening in on the conversations of people who are registering people to vote and things like that.
Well, exactly, and it just shows, you know, the Bush administration and even, you know, following in the footsteps of the McCain campaign have run on this whole thing of trust us. Give us this power, trust us, we'll use it correctly, and if you question us, you're not being patriotic. And what this shows is, yet again, when people are given this kind of power, people are human and they're going to abuse it. And they're going to listen in on things that they should not be listening in on because there is an expectation of privacy, and this gives them the license to listen, like you said, both to people who are activists, people in religious organizations, people in Congress, and, you know, just you or me trying to talk to loved ones back home.
Right. Here's one of the NSA's listeners. Says
calls of American officers.
Of American officers, mostly in the green zone, calling home to the United States, talking to their spouses and sometimes their girlfriends, sometimes on the same days, sometimes one call following another. And co-workers of mine were ordered to transcribe these calls.
David Murphy Falk was a Navy Arab linguist assigned to the NSA facility at Fort Gordon until a year ago.
And when one of my co-workers went to a supervisor and said, but sir, these are personal calls, the supervisor said my orders were to transcribe everything.
We were listening to Iraq.
Those were the same orders Arab linguist Adrian Kinney says she got from her army commanders at the same NSA facility from 2001 to 2003. Kinney says she listened to hundreds of Americans simply calling their families.
Americans in the Middle East calling home.
Oh, most definitely. Like personal, private things with Americans who are not in any way, shape, or form associated with anything to do with terrorism. It was just personal conversations that really nobody else should have been listening to.
And you were.
And we were.
But the law.
There it goes. And that, you know, enough. But
well, and Tom, I think the other thing to keep in mind is we're not dealing with as many resources as we could be. And so when you are a linguist and your job is to transcribe someone saying, hey, mom, can you send me that chili recipe? Or, hey, honey, what are you wearing tonight? They're not then being used to really fight the war on terror, if you want to use that phrase.
Which might have something to do with why Osama bin Laden's still, you know, wandering around with his donkey and his dialysis machine.
Well, exactly. When you misuse our resources like this, it's just, I think it's a crime against the country.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. The Federal Appeals Court Wednesday blocked the planned release of 17 Chinese Muslims from the U.S., from Guantanamo Bay. This story has gone through two or three kind of leapfrog iterations.
Absolutely, and it's one to keep an eye on as well. 4 years ago, the U.S. court system said there are these 17 Chinese Muslims who have been found to have no connection to terrorism. You need to release them. You need to get them out of Guantanamo Bay now. And so there was a big appellate process. And this week, earlier in the week, the court said, okay, we're not playing around anymore. Release these guys. If you don't want to send them back to China because you're afraid they'll be persecuted, they must be released.
In fact, didn't the judge say, I want to see them in front of me in my courtroom?
I want to see them in front of me in my courtroom. I want to make sure they're okay, and then I want them released into U.S. custody.
Right.
And last night, the court said that they're going to, again, postpone this because the White House is resisting it so intensely. And the White House is now saying that a court cannot order non-Americans to be released into U.S. custody, only the executive branch. So they're playing that game again. If the president's not going to do it, nobody's allowed to do it. So this
in other words, we live in a dictatorship. We live in a kingdom.
In a kingdom, yes. And so it's just, you know, I think that's the interesting part of this. You know, it's interesting to follow what's happening to these detainees. But the real takeaway from this is, yet again, the White House is refusing to do what the judicial branch is ordering them to do. And they're saying it's because they're the executive branch and don't have to follow the law.
Right. This is and it could be next month. It could be you or me rather than a Chinese guy in a U.S. prison in Guantanamo.
Well, and they're already doing things and using the executive branch as an excuse against you and me. So it's just something to keep in mind. Just watch them try and play this game once again.
Right. You've written about purging the voting rolls. I did the better part of an hour on that, the last hour of the show, so we can skip over that. But
okay.
This new NIE, both about Afghanistan and and about Iraq, that Iraq might be melting down and Afghanistan might be on the edge.
Let's start with the Afghanistan one, if we could, because
sure.
There's another little wrinkle to this as well. But the NIE is still classified, but there
this
are
is a national intelligence estimate.
The national intelligence estimate, and what it is it's all of the different intelligence agencies of the government, and all of their findings are compiled together in one report. And in this new report, they say that Afghanistan is, quote, in a downward spiral. And this new report supposedly says that they do not think that the Afghan government is going to be able to stem the rise of the Taliban there. And what makes this especially interesting today is that the Admiral Mike Mullen, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff this morning, himself had a breakfast hosted by the Christian Science Monitor newspaper. And he told that newspaper that the trends across the board in Afghanistan, quote, are not going in the right direction. And he really seconded what this NIE says and says that we're not only facing a long, hard slog or whatever the phrase is in Afghanistan, but the way we're going at it right now isn't working.
Well, I think we're the fourth now imperial power in the last 400 years that's tried to occupy Afghanistan without success?
Right. And it's just saying even if we had the resources, he's not even sure that what we're doing is the correct way to go about it. And so the NIE plus Mike Mullen's comments this morning really paint a very dire picture of what's happening in Afghanistan.
And then John McCain claiming credit for the wonders of what is Iraq.
And then, yes, and this I thought was interesting because, you know, every time they're out on the stump, you hear Sarah Palin and John McCain talking about the victory of the surge. And Sarah Palin this morning in the town hall meeting was saying, you know, attacking Obama because whenever he talks about Iraq, he never uses the word victory. She actually said that. And in the new NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, they warned that, quote, unresolved ethnic and sectarian tensions in Iraq could unleash a new wave of violence, potentially reversing the major security and political gains achieved over the last year. And when the McClatchy News Service, which, as you know, is my favorite newspaper, when they were talking about this, they pointed out that even General Petraeus, when he talks about Iraq and Afghanistan, he always calls the situation fragile and reversible and says he'll never use the word victory there.
Right. And that's a direct quote from him. And finally, in Chicago, in Cook County, the sheriff there is saying... Just saying no.
Yeah, it's a guy named Tom Dart, and he's the sheriff of Cook County in Chicago, and he's saying that he is no longer going to use the sheriff's department to evict people from homes that have been foreclosed. And I love this quote. He said, "We will no longer be party to something that's so unjust." And I guess in that county, they've had a lot of instances of innocent people being evicted by the banks because the banks are in trouble. And he said, "We're not going to help."
Right. And probably also renters from people who bought houses on these get-rich-quick schemes, you know, and the renters had no idea that the house had been foreclosed.
Exactly. I just love a guy who'll take a stand.
There you go. It's great. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.com. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 9 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Great to hear your voice. What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, the latest Wall Street Journal forecasting survey says that the U.S. economy has sunk into a recession.
Hmm.
And the government action is critical to stem the damage. So we've got that going on. We've also got this complete change of subject, as I'm jumping around with a bit of ADD going on here.
That's quite all right.
We've got this draft report out, this draft NIE by the American intelligence agencies saying that Afghanistan is in a downward spiral and also casting serious doubt on the ability of the Afghan government to stem the rise in the Taliban's influence. A really very, very grim picture of what's going on in Afghanistan, and also really saying that the U.S. government didn't do what it needed to do quickly enough.
Right. Well, once again, I mean, just like in Iraq. And this is what Obama's been saying from day one, is we should be putting our attention in Afghanistan rather than Iraq. And Iraq actually has the potential not to be a failed state. They've got an enormous amount of oil wealth. Afghanistan has nothing but poppies. You know, they're gonna need some help. They're going to need some major help.
Well, they are. Now, I mean, the one positive thing in a very bizarre way in this report is that they've got a booming heroin trade, which accounts for 50% of their economy. They seem to be incredibly efficient in this.
Yes. And what's so odd is that the first year of his administration, you'll recall, George W. Bush gave the Taliban $50 million, as I recall, to stop the heroin trade. And they did. They did. They went out and they took down the poppies and they passed the money out to the people. And said, you know, we'll buy your poppies and destroy them, and the price of heroin went up in Europe. And right now, the price of heroin in Europe is one third of what it was when Bush came into office. It's down around $3, $4, $5 a hit because there's so much cheap heroin coming in from Afghanistan. It's got the Europeans totally freaked out.
It's, you know, I asked Dana Perino about this, about the fact that the CIA has said, many in the CIA are saying that the U.S. government has been very slow to respond to this, and I got my face slapped, so.
How so?
I literally got my face slapped. I was basically told that she'd already responded, but the fact was that she hadn't responded to that question. She had spoken a little bit about U.S. policy in Afghanistan, but she hadn't responded to that question. So apparently she didn't wish to respond to that question.
Apparently, yeah. Well, it's sort of like apparently she was asked about, well, in fact, we played the audio of it earlier, of her being asked about extending unemployment benefits for another 7 weeks. Oh, no, we think that the best thing for people to do is get a job.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
It so is an echo of Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake.
There is a genuine disconnect, and yet I have to tell you, I know these people. These are not bad people.
No, but she went on to say, you know, that she'd never been unemployed, and she has a hard time imagining what it would be like, and she's employed, and she has a good job, and so, you know, and so, I guess we have to cut her a little slack for being, you know, young, dumb, and naive. I don't know, but are these the people that we want running our country?
Well, you have to ask that question. Do we want running the bailout plan a 35-year-old graduate of Goldman Sachs?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. The guy that Henry Paulin Henry Paulson.
That was a very interesting Freudian slip.
Yeah.
Tom.
They're all just, you know, morphing into one giant blob in my brain. You know, the whole Bush-McCain administration. Campaign, everything, it's all, you know, and Karl Rove is at the center of it all. You know, the world is getting strange, Victoria. You know, the New York Times today came out with a story about how voters are being thrown off the voting rolls all across the United States, how in Colorado now there are 100,000 fewer people registered to vote than there were 4 years ago, even though there's been massive voter registration drives.
Yes.
This story, on the one hand, this is a real double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I think that this kind of story needs to get out there, it needs to be talked about, and it needs to be pushed back. You know, the New York Times pointing out that most of these states are in violation of federal law. This needs to be undone, and it needs to be undone quickly, and people need to be put back on the voter rolls. On the other hand, the story being picked up by the corporate media is maybe used as a way, you know, when the election is over and the dust settles, if John McCain is the one that they anoint president, will be the backstory, the narrative. You know, just like the backstory, the narrative that was used in Florida was, well, it was, you know, Ralph Nader. And, you know, even though it's nonsense, you know. And it'll be the rationale. I'm very, very concerned about this.
Well, the only thing that one of the things I thought about the story was that it came out early enough that it's possible that maybe they could do something about all these people having been purged from the rolls.
Right, and that's why I was frankly very pleased to see it in the New York Times today, because, you know, it's been limited to, you know, places like Brad Blog and Mark Crispin Miller's blog and my blogs and my, you know, my articles in Common Dreams over the last 6 years on these topics, and you know, now the New York Times, you know, it's like, I guess the rest of America is starting to wake up. Do you think that the Democratic Party will abandon the Bob Schrum strategies of the Kerry campaign and the Gore campaign of refusing to talk about vote fraud and election fraud, and perhaps do something?
Yes, I think maybe they're going to do something.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, join us for Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders joins us with all the news from Washington, D.C., and he'll take your calls and answer your questions. Plus, Anything Goes Friday and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Do something today. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.